Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck and I host this show. My guest is Dan L. Hayes, author of Freedom is Just Another Word. The themes running through the book encompass the father-son relationship, adult children of alcoholics, Al-Anon with 12 steps of recovery, as well as overcoming post-traumatic stress syndrome to release blocks to a creative life. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Dan L. Hayes. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Kate. How are you doing today?
Wonderful. And Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. Thank you.
I would like you, if you could, I'm sure you can, describe for us what your healing journey has been like for you.
Ooh, if I really tried to describe it in full detail, it would take about 3 hours. It's been a long and somewhat bendy process, I would call it. I had the thought that my life was fairly normal, except some things just weren't fitting in, back as far as the early 80s, when I was in my early 30s. I got into a group that was for people who had grown up with alcoholism. It was a 12-step group. And yet what I was saying was, well, yeah, I grew up with alcoholism. There was some drinking, but I remember saying this one time, it was a garden variety alcoholic household. Nothing much happened.
Ooh.
No. Exactly. I later laughed extremely much at that remark because the more I got into it, the more things started to come together and pieces started to fall into place. So it was really, that was the starting point. That was the starting point.
Is it that you couldn't remember? That was my curious question as I was reading your book.
That was why I said it was a garden variety alcoholic household and nothing much happened, because I didn't.
Yeah.
But
right.
At the time of the events of that book, the way I phrase it to people that helps them see it is, if you remember the movie The Bourne Identity?
Yes.
Matt Damon, and he wakes up and he starts having flashbacks to a world and a life that he never knew existed.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't
mm-hmm.
connect them to reality as he knew it today. That's what I was having. You know, I was starting to have flashbacks. I was early in the book, I'd start to get these little bits of memories. I was at a 12-step meeting one time, and this angry man was leading the meeting, and I think he was trying to talk about how he wasn't angry. And he slapped his fist down on the chair next to him.
Yeah.
What? I just almost jumped out of my seat, and it helped me remember an incident with my dad where something very similar had happened. I came home very excited about having published in eighth grade, having published some of my poetry in our school literary magazine, and he slapped his fist down on the chair and said, "Poems, you little bleep, you'll never amount to anything."
No.
And that was the start of my creative lockup.
Yeah.
Because the next 14 years, I didn't write at all. I barely could finish a thesis in graduate school for business because it was so painful to try to write.
Right.
You know, so that's the sort of thing that I was starting to remember. I was starting to put the pieces together. And I had the feeling there was more there, but, you know, how do you get to it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, you had mentioned that you were a student of Julia Cameron's The Artist Way. And one of the things she does, of course, so have I been as well, one of the things she mentions is when people, the critic, when you hand your work over to somebody and they just trash it. That is just one of the worst things that can happen to a creative person. Or, and like I have, I believe we are all creative, and we are all easily wounded in our creative process by that kind of insult, you know, to our creativity.
Sure. Well, and particularly when it's your father that you worship.
Yeah.
You know, that was, that made it even more painful. And mind you, I lived for, I want to say, let me see, 14, 34. I lived for 22 years after that without even remembering that event because it was so painful. My I just buried it down deep in my soul.
Yes.
You know, and it, what happened to me, Kate, as my healing journey unfolded, I was going to a lot of 12-step meetings. I had bought into the program enough. I got really lucky. I've been very blessed. I had a sponsor who was long-term 12-step, but who was also a therapist.
And I talked to him.
He was a genius. He started me doing a lot of things that were non-traditional 12-step, but that I needed in my tool arsenal, if you will, to try to begin to dig out from this hole. And so I started doing all of that, and that's when the memory started coming back together, and things started falling into place that, okay, it wasn't an average alcoholic household. I started having sort of clues early in that process. One night we were playing volleyball at the church, and one of my buddies, after a play, he kind of punched the ball, and it popped up and hit me in the chest. Boy, I got over in his face, and I had my fist cocked, and I was getting ready to throw down on him. And another buddy of mine, who we were all on the same softball team together, another buddy of mine, he came over and he laughed and he started doing the same thing like I was because they both thought I was kidding. What they didn't know was I was serious. I was about to seriously injure this guy. Well, a third buddy of ours, the first baseman on the team, called me the next morning. He was standing right there, and he called me the next morning and said, "Hey, let's go to lunch." And he confronted me about being a very angry person. Well, my mask had always been for 20 years, laughing, happy-go-lucky, Joker Dan. So for this anger to start coming out, and for him to say it, he said it just in the time where I was ready to see it.
Yeah.
You know, and that was one
That's
of the first things.
Gift.
It was a huge gift. It was a huge gift, but it was the sort of the wake-up call I needed to say, okay, what's going on here?
Yes.
Well, then another time, I had written a poem right about the time of the events with my dad called The Demon. That was one of the poems published in this literary magazine. And it was the volcano, the angry volcano, wakens from its slumber, pouring lava from its lips like angry words hastily spoken, trying to shame someone below it. I read that to my sponsor and I said, well, you know, that's about my dad. And his response was, is it? Yikes.
Yeah.
So those wake-up calls and the awareness that I had an intimate acquaintance with violence that I didn't understand. You know, I did a prison ministry when I was in my early 30s, and here's this skinny little white guy. We'd go into the Texas prisons, which are pretty rough, and the better part of the weekend witnessing to the inmates. And, Kate, they afforded me an incredible amount of respect that I couldn't figure out. And I figured out later that they knew that I had intimately been involved with some kind of violence. They could see it in my eyes.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I didn't know it. So all of those clues made me decide I need to really dig in here and see what's going on.
Yes. Well, yeah, because they can see. They're very street smart people.
Sure. Oh yeah, they could see one of the guys said you've got that 1,000-yard stare like a combat veteran has.
Yeah, you're looking around to see when the danger's coming up, huh?
Sure. Well, and it's really funny because back at that time, post-traumatic stress disorder, aka combat fatigue, wasn't being talked about that much yet, but I ran across an article, or I guess a book, in the library that had a description of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
One of the things it has is just what you're talking about, what's called hypervigilance, where I used to call it my on patrol mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like I was in the bush and the gooks were everywhere.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, so I'm like, okay, what's that about? You know, I had a sleep disorder where I'd go to bed reasonably tired. I'd exercise that day, go to bed at 11 o'clock, and suddenly I'd pop wide awake until 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of thing. The anger issues, I had a suicidal episode, had substance abuse issues, depression issues. All of these things were going on. And so as I looked down the list of what it describes as post-traumatic stress disorder, I said, well, that sure sounds like me. But
yeah.
the only problem was it said that post-traumatic stress disorder is caused by when you basically are faced with or in fear of your life from some violent incident where there's the threat of death. Well, I didn't have one of those.
Right.
You know, that I could remember. Yeah. So that's...
That you could remember, right.
Right, that I could remember, but I showed a lot of signs that sure seemed to point that way.
Yes.
You know, so that...
So you're the relationship with your father, you know, the father-son relationship, your relationship with your father was very complicated.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll complicate it even one more step.
Mm-hmm.
After all of this happened in the, I want to say, from 1963 to 1967, my dad sobered up.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next 20 years, he was a member of AA, and he was a kind of a bedrock of the community.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, okay, that's complicating it even more.
Yes.
You know, we had a wall between us that neither one of us knew what it was about. But it's hard to get mad at your dad when he's really trying his best and he's put his whole life back together. And he's modeling, in some ways, a healthy lifestyle.
Did he make amends with you?
No, and several people have asked about that, but I think he never made amends because he was blacked out.
Yeah, he doesn't remember. Yeah, he didn't remember.
Yeah, he made amends in a lot of ways, sort of a living amends, by reconnecting with me. You know, like about a year before he passed away, I said, Dad, you always say you don't want to mess in my business, but I sure like for you to find out what's going on with me. I'd love it if you'd call me occasionally and ask how I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he did. He did, you know, on a regular basis. He invested in me. He kind of was overprotective and didn't want to jump in the middle of my stuff, but I invited him in. We bonded. We had
mm-hmm.
a lot of healing, given that we had something going on that neither one of us knew about or remembered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because neither one of you could remember.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's funny because as you've been reading my book, what basically things were really coming unraveled for me in about, the fall of 1987. And in the middle of that, my dad died.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only after that, after about a number of events happened, that I remembered the violent incident that made the PTSD make sense. And people have said, well, do you think you would have remembered that before your dad died? And I said, you know, I'm not sure. Only
yeah.
after he died was part of me safe enough to say, let's go find out what happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, but the other part for me that was very, here's my motivation. My dad, I think he was carrying PTSD just like me from some things that happened to him in the Marine Corps.
I was going to ask if he was in the war of any, in the military.
He was in Hawaii in 1946. It was still considered wartime, but he was not in combat.
Uh-huh.
He witnessed and experienced some things in the Marine Corps that he later passed on to me when he was drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So he had PTSD too. But Kate, what I watched that was my really motivating factor, he sobered up in 67. He had, when he was age 44, he had a heart attack, major heart attack. When he was 47, he had open heart surgery. When
mm-hmm.
he was 51, he had a colostomy. When he was 59, he died of a stroke.
Yeah.
And I knew, I was 37 at the time I was watching that, and I knew if I didn't do something different, I was headed down that same road. You know, I was very clear. I was either going to end up in prison for something violent or die somehow. You know, either health-related problems or just doing something stupid.
Yes.
You know, I was a train wreck waiting to happen, so that was my motivation for a number of years to dig down into this stuff.
Yes.
You know, now, fast forward, when I was 59 years old myself, the same age my dad was when he died,
mm-hmm.
I went to the doctor for my annual physical, and he looked at the results, and he said, so, other than a few allergies, you don't have anything wrong with you. It
mm-hmm.
took me a while for that statement to sink in.
Yes.
You know, it was like, wow. You know, I ran 3 marathons in my early 50s. I've never had anything close to a heart attack or anything like that. I still work out about 4 times a week.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's my healing path at work.
Yeah. So your dad became kind of a spiritual leader of Alcoholics Anonymous in his home group, perhaps, or in,
mm-hmm.
in the groups that he led. And it was interesting because somebody during the funeral, around the time of the funeral, some recovering alcoholic had said to you that your father had saved his life.
Yep.
But in reality, you saved his life that one night when he really was about to commit suicide.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. That's
yeah.
amazing. Amazing insight, yes.
Well, yes. As I was reading the book, and I may have messaged you, and I thought, well, you probably didn't see it. There's just no doubt in my mind that you saved his life so that he could go on and save other people's lives. But it was hard for you to understand that he was the spiritual giant that he was. And it's hard for the family members. They say a prophet in his own town or whatever. You know, somehow people become prophets all over the world, but when they're not recognized in their hometown or wherever. But it sounds like you really released him that night, because it did sound like he was about to kill himself.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt.
Yeah,
yeah. In the well,
so he was mad at you because you kind of broke it up.
Well, I think honestly. Okay, let me just flesh out a little bit background on here for the people who might not have read the book.
Yeah.
What happened
do.
When I was 17 years old, my parents moved from Farmington, New Mexico, where I grew up, to Oklahoma City. My dad, they wanted to relocate him because that was all they knew back then to try to fix somebody who had a drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
But he took it with him. And I think he either was about to lose his job or had just lost his job. I had just started working, bussing tables and washing dishes at a hamburger restaurant. In the middle of the winter, I walked in to the house late at night, like 1 o'clock in the morning. Usually by then he was drunk. And instead of being
passed
drunk...
Drunk and passed out.
Exactly, passed out. So he was safe to be around. And I walked in, and he was still awake, and he said, where have you been? I said, well, I've been at my job. And he said, don't you ever think you're better than me just because you've got a job.
Mm-hmm.
And that it led to some violence. And basically, he was sitting there with a hunting rifle that I'd seen him kill deer with. And that's what you were referring to, that I think he was
mm-hmm.
about to commit suicide. And instead, I walked out of the room thinking I was about to get shot with a high-powered rifle.
Mm-hmm.
That was the interruption that, yes, it did. What happened? How did that interrupt the process and stop it? I'll never know completely, but it did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he went on and put his life back together, and then I was left with this jagged wound that I couldn't remember.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Always feeling like you were going to be shot in the back. You had a pain right there in your back.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think it's in the book that, well, after my dad died, I was writing a poem to honor him. I was feeling the grief about it, and yet I was feeling this really ugly anger coming to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally had to sit down and write about it. I wrote about it. I was angry at my dad, God, and the church, and not necessarily in that order. just kind of this whole patriarchal scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of the 12-step program for me to, I needed to share that with somebody, get it off my system,
right.
Get it out of my system. So I went and talked to a minister at my church. And this is where it connects with your comment, Kate, because he's, after I read that, he said, you know, you're absolutely right. You're feeling of what a lot of people would feel, but they just don't want to talk about it in church. And he said, don't be surprised if this doesn't bring up something more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Prophetic. Well, I, you know, just like you were saying, I had that itch right in the middle of my back for a long time. I could feel something there. And a week after I went and saw the minister, I had a dream where somebody was chasing me with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into an abandoned mine opening. And then when I got in there, I realized that I was trapped. And I turned around and looked, and the guy with the gun was my dad.
Mm-hmm.
That was what led me to say, I need to dig deeper. I need to find out what's really going on here. And about
right.
2 weeks after that, I remembered the incident. My sponsor had given me the tool of a gestalt exercise where I sat in one chair and put my inner child in the other chair and said, Danny, can you come out and tell me what happened?
Mm-hmm.
And the full details of that violent incident in Oklahoma City came to the surface, and it was like, everything. You know, Kate, honestly, that didn't fix anything. It brought
mm-hmm.
everything to the
mm-hmm.
surface where now I know what I've got to work on, and now I know why I'm showing all these signs of PTSD.
Yeah.
You know, very, very powerful turning point. Now, if you remember in the book, what I did, I had a very large male in the room who was in my therapy group, my men's group,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because I figured my inner child needed to know that there was somebody big enough to take care of dad if he came in the room.
Yeah.
You know, and I got the memory back, and there you go. Now I know
mm-hmm.
what I've got to deal with, you know?
Yes. Now, you were doing I know about Alcoholics Anonymous because I went through recovery, and, you know, I'm in recovery for
uh-huh.
alcoholism. So I know you were doing a fifth step with your minister.
Sure.
And what you were doing is uncovering the resentments that will kill anybody, basically.
Sure.
But, of course, it kills the alcoholic faster, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so by digging up those resentments, you were able to bring them to light, and then that was the necessary next step is what happened for you, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely it was, and it was the case where I had been furious at God for 20 years and trying to go to church and say, I love you, God. Well, no wonder there's a disconnect there.
Yeah. Well, and also you had a concept of God that wasn't a loving God.
Sure. He was an angry alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, yes. And I think a lot of people do that. I modeled him after my dad, but not my dad when he was in recovery, my dad when he was drunk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, basically he's there to punish you.
How does your family think of your writing about these things? And
they love it.
You know how it is. So many times, that's always a question that comes up when you write about your family. That
sure.
What do they think? And your mom in particular. Is your mother still alive?
Uh huh. She's still alive.
Uh huh.
She loves it. She thinks
Good.
It's wonderful. If you notice, the book is not about my mom because she is still alive, and I'd rather get into those issues. In deference to her, I don't get into those. I wanted to stay focused on my dad. But she's read the book a number of times. She's shared it with a lot of people, including I'm living in Fort Worth now, and she's here as well. She's shared
mm-hmm.
it with people who knew him in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And some
wow.
of her friends, some of her friends said, I don't want to read about Benny Lowell when he was in high school, or I don't want to read about him, whatever Dan says, because I think he's going to say that the guy's a bad guy. And I remember him as the guy on the football team, the president of the student body, and the guy we all loved, which he was. You know, I mean, I dealt with two dads. When my
mm-hmm.
dad was sober, he was a brilliant and gifted man. When he was drunk, his demons would come out.
Yes, yes.
You know, and now, recently, Kate, they started reading it, and they go, wow, this is amazing, because I don't
no, you
focus
don't.
On my dad as a bad guy.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
And that's a gift. That's why it's a great book. And people,
well, thank you.
Because you are very compassionate about your father, and it's very, the father-son relationship is really explored in that book. And people always have issues with their father. And
sure.
I understand, especially men, I mean, father-son stuff. And a lot of the stuff that happens, what do you think happened to your father in the military? Because a lot of the post-traumatic, I know he wasn't in combat, but the men that came out of World War II, Korea, even Vietnam, with alcohol problems really had some issues, to say the least.
I connected with a guy on Twitter who was a Vietnam vet, and he said, my buddies in combat told me I had PTSD before I ever went over there.
There you go.
I think my dad had I gone into the military, I would have gone in with a case of PTSD, just like I think my dad did.
Yes.
And it's mainly because he grew up with his mom. And his mom is the focus of my next book about the whole creative writing block.
Mm-hmm.
And she had, I mean, my dad was a gifted writer, and I didn't find out about it until about 10 years after he died.
Really? What kind of stuff was he writing?
He gave me the clue. He wrote a short story that he published turned it into an English course at Texas Christian University.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about an incident in the Marine Corps, surprisingly.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've ever watched the movie Full Metal Jacket.
I think I have. I don't like movies like that.
Sure. No, I don't blame you. That was, for me, a therapy movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Stanley Kubrick, and it's about Marine Corps boot camp training program. And in there's an incident where they scapegoat one boot. And the drill instructor focuses all their hatred on that one guy. And so late at night, they punish him. They go in and beat this guy up.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad wrote a story about that happening, and I think he left it a little bit loose, but I think he participated.
Yeah.
It scarred him, because later he acted that out on me. Some of the stuff that went on before the violent incident was him coming into my room and beating me up just the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I mean, he's a sensitive, compassionate Renaissance man who got drafted in the Marine Corps instead of getting to go to college his first year, and it tore him up.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, so that's where I believe his PTSD came from. Now, granted, a secondary cause. My grandmother was, I've come to believe, just full-on crazy. You know, there's just no way around it. She was just a nut woman, and he had to grow. I spent a couple summers being around her. He grew up with her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so as I started seeing it, Kate, I think the turning point for me toward compassion was when I realized that had I gone through what my dad did, I could have done exactly to me what he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the setup was there. The setup was absolutely there. I had that same capacity. I remember even one of my girlfriends saying one time, oh, well, if I do that again, just hit me.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I never did that, but I think there were certain angry women that were drawn to the violence that they saw in me and even, like, you know, went up and poked me in the chest verbally or emotionally to try to pull out that violence.
Mm-hmm. Because you know, they had some issues themselves of poor self-image, etc.
Yeah, we were doing the dance of anger, and they wanted me to dance. And I was desperately trying my best not to dance.
Yes.
In about 86, I spent about a year in a boxing gym, working out, punching on a punching bag as hard as I could, you know, five or six times a week, just to try to bleed down the anger. You know, and I
did
thought
that
all
help
of
you?
Oh, it's enormously. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, my sponsor was showing me all these things. Kate, I would do things like I would keep a tennis racket next to my couch. And if I thought I might be angry, he'd say, just go in there and pat it on the couch a couple times. Well, you know, we know what would happen. I'd pat it on the couch. 2 seconds later, I'm knocking all the dust out of my couch. You know, I would do that. I had a Van Halen tape. I would drive up and down the street with Van Halen tape with the windows rolled up, playing Panama as loud as I could and screaming, primal screams. I showed up at many 12-step meetings hoarse, and people said, "You're doing it again, aren't you?" Yeah, that
oh,
was,
thank God for the 12-step program, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because
well,
there's so many people who do not, in your position, will not, do not, take advantage of the great gifts of those programs.
Sure, sure. Oh, you know, it's funny because I've talked about this a number of times, Kate. I had been going to church. I had been going to Bible study. I'd been trying to find some way to find solutions for what I was dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I've used the artist's way, therapy, number of different modalities, and a lot of different tools. But if you said you can only have one tool,
it would
be the 12 steps.
Right.
It is a concise spiritual solution path for what was ailing me. And it took me a lot, you know, and as a writer, I did this one time. I went and looked at the words of the 12 steps, and it's like there is not a waste word in there.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Well, Bill W. was one of the most amazingly creative geniuses that ever lived. And they call him the social architect of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Think of that. Wow.
Well, I mean, you know, before he came along, they were saying they're incurable. Throw them in an insane asylum.
Yes.
About alcoholics because they didn't.
Absolutely.
They didn't have,
yeah.
They had found nothing that gave even a chance to work. You know. So yeah. That was a well. And it's funny because this 12-step program for people who had grown up with alcoholism came along and started to blossom just when I needed it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
You know, because and I'll be honest. AA, I have had a hard time going to because I didn't realize for a long time what was going on. I'd go in there and some guy would talk and it would flare up my PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They'd tell their stories, yeah.
Yeah, it was my dad. Or even if they talked a certain way or carried themselves a certain way, it would really trigger me. And I didn't know, I mean, I was just terrified. I couldn't successfully get in there. But this other one, now, of course, my sponsor, he was also long-term in AA. Mm-hmm. What I discovered after about 5 years was he was feeding me the solid principles without telling me what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like, I'm not going to tell you this is broccoli casserole because you don't think you like broccoli. Here, eat this. and I loved it. You know, I am so well grounded. And even, you know, my mom's been in recovery for 40 plus years, and she said, "Oh, Dan, you got such a gift with that man."
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
does she go to meetings herself?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, she's
well,
very
I was
active.
My very favorite meeting of all times was when we would meet on a Saturday night and read the 12 steps book that Bill W. wrote. So you know, it would be the step and then his commentary of it. We read it over and over and over again. You know, and for several years before the meeting sort of fizzled out. But it was just a tremendous insight. And every time we would read it, there would be something, a new layer would
I knew it, knew exactly. Yep. My home group for about 8 to 10 years was a Friday night step study.
Mm-hmm.
And it was exactly that. And it was just like amazing. You know, you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 2, 12. And then when you got to 1, hey, I hadn't quite heard it like that before.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Exactly.
You know, amazing gift. So it was a tremendous gift to me, and I will always be grateful for it, and I'm alive because of it.
That's right. And so your father was somebody who had also benefited quite a bit from the 12 steps, and it probably saved his life up until his health, you know, did him in, but. But and I was going to ask you now, let's be real, your father really didn't die. Nobody really does. That's my philosophy. So have you had communication with him from the other side?
About a year after he passed away, just as I was drifting off to sleep, I heard him say, "Let me go."
Aw. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was like, yeah, that's what I needed. I needed to have that peace. And then another thing that I did, was I wrote a piece called A Conversation with Dad.
Mm.
And it was what I would imagine that I wanted to say to him and what I would imagine that he would have said to me in return. And I actually shared that at a men's retreat one night.
Mm-hmm.
As part of my healing process, because I had a pretty good idea of what we both wanted to, if we knew what we didn't know before he died.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of my way of making peace with him in that context.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a very, and I later they lived in the final years of their lives, they lived in Tulsa, and I did several ritual visits to Tulsa to connect with him and to say, Dad, I went out to the land that he used to own. He owned like 5 acres that he planted.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I went back out to that land and read A Conversation with Dad to him out there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. I knew he would hear it.
Yeah.
You know, and it,
because
and
he
the,
probably was, I mean, you know, obviously he's everywhere, but he's probably was very much there in spirit more than other places.
If you remember in the book, right after he passed, we made arrangements for the funeral, and then we had a couple days. Well, I started driving his pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I wanted to do that was very important to me, I went out to his land, and I put on his boots, I took out his chainsaw, and I cut down 3 dead trees.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last project he and I worked on together. He was out there grafting pecan trees, and I was clearing out some underbrush. So that was the first place I wanted to go.
Right.
You know,
right.
Very, very powerful. Very powerful.
And what about this grandmother? Was she?
Well,
did she have drinking problems, or was it really mental health problems mostly?
I think it was mental
health. And he was raised by her, right? He was raised by her.
His dad left when he was 11 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My first therapist picked up on that because my dad, there was a turning point with my dad where he turned against me, and it was about when I was 12 years old, and my therapist said, "When did your dad's father leave?"
Yeah.
It was at that same age. So he spent the next 7 or 8 years living alone with the crazy woman.
Oh,
you know,
that's
and,
really tough.
Well, and it's funny because what I had done, I had thought that my writing block was about the events with my dad.
Yeah.
In particularly where he shamed my poetry, that sort of stuff. That's what I thought for about 15 years. In 1985, I wrote a book. It was kind of like my autobiography of growing up with alcoholism. I had a very successful publisher, very interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know Dr. Claudia Black, have you heard of her?
I've heard of her.
She wrote a book called It Will Never Happen to Me, which at the time was the only book out there about growing up with an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband called me back about 3 days after I sent him the manuscript and said, I love this book, I want to publish it.
Oh.
And instead of being exciting, it terrified me.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know why. And I had Health Communications also interested. And they were the company, the outfit that published Sharon Wexhider-Cruz, Melody Beatty, a number of those people. They grew very big.
Yeah.
And this was before they had taken off. They also, mm-hmm. I did a complete rewrite for them. I walked away. In 1993... I decided I needed to explore what happened with my dad after that event with him, because basically he disappeared for about 7 or 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And before he died, I never asked him what happened. So and my mom had said, well, he went out and worked on the wheat harvest for a while. He had a spiritual awakening somehow in that wheat harvest, came back, sobered up, got into recovery, and a changed man.
Mm-hmm.
As part of my healing, I decided I need to explore what that looked like. Well, it was one of those God things, Kate, because I mentioned it to one of my buddies that someday, if I'm ever going to finish this book about my dad, I need to go work on the wheat harvest.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he said, well, Dan, if you ever someday want to do that, I have relatives in Oklahoma who work the wheat harvest every year.
Oh, that's neat.
Gulp. Well, and my dad would have started the wheat harvest in Oklahoma. So I ended up working 2 summers on the wheat harvest to explore this story, and as part of my healing process, I wrote a second book. It was a novel. It was called Nothing Left to Lose. And it was my dad's story. And, Kate, it was really funny because it was a story from a very loving perspective about what happened to him. Had publishers interested, guess what happened? Walked away again.
Walked away, yeah.
You know, and it got so frustrating for a while that I said, you know, if this doesn't, if I can't figure this writing block thing out, I'm just going to give up writing and take up golf. And I actually even bought a set of golf clubs at one point. Well, what happened was, I after all of that took place, I went out, I moved out to New Mexico, and a therapist I was working with said, you've got something really deeply buried. And I'm thinking, wow, I got back the memory from Dad 15 years ago. What could be buried still? Well, I through a sequence of events, went up and to where I'd grown up, Farmington, which was a very safe place at this point. And I did another inner child exercise. What came out was that my grandmother, we were living in Farmington. I took a bus down to Fort Worth to spend a couple weeks with family during the summer. When I got off the bus and we went home, my grandmother said, what do you want to be when you grow up? Oh, that's easy. I want to be a famous writer. And this was when I was 8 years old, because when I was 6 years old, I knew I was going to be a writer when I grew up. That was my only dream. And she said, oh, you don't want to do that. And I said, why not? She said, well, because if you do that, they'll call you crazy and lock you up. You know, just out of the blue. And then harped on that for a whole week. Well, basically.
Oh, my gosh.
No, it was just, it was like, oh, well, that's interesting. What it turned out was that that was the first of three parts of the event that happened that I remembered over about a 4-year period. It had to come out gently, but for 45 years I had buried that memory. She was a nurse. She told me later that the doctor she worked for said, yes, if he grows up and he's a writer and he goes crazy, I can have him committed to an insane asylum. I don't think that ever happened, but I think that's what she told me.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I can't see a prudent doctor saying, yeah, go tell your 8-year-old grandson, I'll have him committed.
No.
You know. So this, and then later she reinforced it. Well, that's been my healing journey, was to try to pull all that to the surface.
Right.
Yeah. And strangely,
well, in those days, they did think that writers were insane people or alcoholics, committed suicide, like Ernest Hemingway and all this and that. Yeah.
And that was right during the time when Hemingway was imploding. You know, so yeah, that would have been all. You know, I mean, the question that I've always had is, where did she get that question? Why did she even think to ask me that? And I think somehow on a subconscious level, because she talked to my dad like every week, I just have always wondered if somehow he planted a seed. Because right during that time, I was very active with writing. I was taking piano lessons and apparently was extraordinarily gifted with it. And my dad instead was trying to pull me away towards sports. You know, so there was all of this conflict going on around Dan. And that's how it came out. And what forced it to the surface was when I, this book about the wheat harvest, I realized that there was some backstory to that. Because how did I get to where I could talk about the man who acted violence on me from such a loving perspective? I need to explain that process. And so that was where Freedom's Just Another Word, the book that you've just read, came from, was I need to start back there and show the process of how I got to the loving place.
Yes.
You know, and
because it's the loving place where all creativity springs, you know, where you can be fully creative.
Sure. I can't be creative when I've got that much angst and anger.
Right.
You know, so, But doing that, writing that book, I started writing that book in 2005, and that's what forced all the grandma stuff to the surface, because this is my third book. And Kate, I just on some level, I'd worked the artist's way at that point. I'd done a lot of step work about it. I just knew that I was actually going to publish this book.
Yes.
And that was, on subconscious level, going to make grandma's prophecy come true.
Yeah.
For my 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was it. All the pieces started falling in place. And I didn't see this at the time. I kind of had an idea that, hey, something's getting forced to the surface. But I didn't see how deeply rooted it was.
Right.
Yeah, so my process was to write this book and publish the book and then start publicizing the book and doing radio interviews about it, which all contributed to bringing the grandma stuff to the light. You know, one of my sponsors' old favorite sayings was, he called it the Dracula theory, that if you expose the old lies to the light, just like Dracula, they wither up and die.
The light. Bring it to the light. Yeah.
Yeah, bring it to the light. And that's what it did.
Now, is this your first published book then?
Yes.
The Freedom is
Freedom's just another word, and that's from Janis Joplin, me and Bobby McGee.
Yes.
And Nothing Left to Lose is the other part of that line, which is going to be the book about, the novel about my dad, which I will publish after two or three of these intervening books. You know, the next one, which I'm going to publish next spring, is going to be called Healing the Writer.
Oh, good.
And that's the one about grandma, you know, about working through PTSD through a writing process.
Mm-hmm.
Because the process of writing the book about grandma and how that all came about kind of helped my healing process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it all sort of fits together. And then the one that's going to come after that is going to be called The Tiger Unveiled.
About
when Dan gets in touch with his anger. You know, I did a radio interview about Freedom's Just Another Word, and it's very interesting because most of the people that I interview with say, okay, tell me about the violent incident. Well, this guy is a guy named Cyrus Webb. He skipped straight over that. And he said, tell me about the tiger dream.
Uh-huh.
I had about 2 weeks after I remembered the violent incident with my dad, I had a dream where I was taking a friend to see my new house. I had this wonderful new house with all these wonderful rooms in it. Some of them I hadn't even explored yet. Mm-hmm. I opened the front door for her to go in, and she gasped because inside was a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, don't worry, he's tame, he's not harmful, he won't hurt you. And at that moment, the tiger came up and put his mouth around my forearm.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't bite down, but just enough where I could feel his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I knew the tiger was not safe, and he would eventually destroy me.
Mm-hmm.
And that tiger was my rage.
Mm-hmm.
That was my legacy of the violence, was that tiger. And how all that kind of came about for me to confront that and to deal with, I mean, on a real functional, deep level, that anger is going to be this next book after the one I published this spring. And then I'll go back and publish the novel about my dad.
So are you thinking of helping others through their creative blocks? Like you could teach conferences or you could do online stuff. You know, probably that would be a good thing to do.
I haven't thought about it in that way yet, and mainly because writer's block and what I experienced are kind of two different animals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mine's writer's block that's a result of PTSD, and I don't think most people have that. Now, could I help somebody if they wanted to? Absolutely. I have just, it's funny because I'm going to speak at what's called a Survivor Summit next April in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it's going to be talking about this book and my creative process and my creative healing process.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect it's only the speakers are all writers. So
yeah.
I think the speaking from that perspective and what I can share about the healing journey, there will be some use for it. I don't know what that is going to look like just yet.
Yeah, I think it's going to evolve. And you could do workshops for vets. And now, you know, the whole idea of post-traumatic stress does seem to come out of the war scenario, but I think it obviously comes from a lot of the childhood trauma.
Sure.
And people are blocked creatively because of their childhood trauma, and they don't even think they're creative and all this and that. I think that you could really help people with this whole theme.
It's like a buddy of mine said the other day at lunch. He said, "Dan, you have got all these gifts and talents and experiences from trying to publish your book and working through this healing process. There's got to be a way to share all that."
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're talking about. And I'm looking for it, but I haven't quite seen it yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's going to come something. Well, it's just like back in 86, before I got into all this stuff, we used to have a 12-step retreat at a retreat center in Houston. And you'd go through the 12 steps in meetings throughout the weekend. And then on Saturday night, they'd kind of shut down the official meetings, but they'd have around 8 or 9 o'clock, they'd have an unofficial meeting. And usually it would be around the topic of sex, because everybody wanted to do that. Well, after we'd done it a couple times, I raised my hand before they shut down for the day and said, "Hey, I know we're going to have this meeting over here, but if anybody wants to talk about creativity, I'm going to be over in the library."
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it was, because I need to talk about my creativity. Well, 15 people showed up.
I'm not surprised.
Exactly confirming what you... And that became... We had a number of retreats, and that became one of the focal points, was the creativity issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to take this to heart, that you've given me a direction.
Yeah, I would.
You know, mm-hmm. I don't know what the direction looks like yet, but I know it's there. You know?
Well, even though this is a very busy week for people, on the page where I was inviting people to come to this radio show, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people listening on the archives, but what I was really interested in, how it really sparked people's interest, people I wouldn't have necessarily thought it would. And I think that our creativity is at the heart of our ability to survive, if not more than survive, but to thrive.
Sure.
And like, for instance, I have a blog, and I'm trying to publish a book about, that kind of stems from the blog itself, but it was every day I would write prayers for 365 days, and during that process of writing those prayers for 365 days, I fell. I had a major fall, and in that, but the thing was so interesting. I was wondering, gosh, I had slammed my head, my face was all bleeding. It was, and I remember thinking, I can't let this get me down. I have to write a prayer. The whole thing being that we have, it gives us a sense of purpose in life to create, to be. In that creative flow, however that creativity expresses itself, whether it be writing or singing or playing instruments or even dancing, or just the fact is that life is a creative process, and the more cheerful, the more optimistic, the more giving, the more loving we are, the more that creativity will unblock, and the more it flows.
Sure.
So my point being that this is, I think, something that people really need to hear. You hear so many people say, "I'm not creative." Well, that's impossible.
Sure. Well, it's funny because in the original series of books that I envisioned, I was going to do this book later. But the person who edited my first book said, "Dan, I think people are going to need this book first because it's going to explain so much of what goes after it."
Right.
And she said at the time, she said, "Dan, I think the grandma book is going to be one of the most powerful books you ever write." And I think as I've been moving forward in writing it, and this is the way I let things get cold. I haven't looked at the first 30 chapters of this book in about a year. And I think when I go back and look at what I did, because it's like one of the things that people really take away from Freedom is Just Another Word, is it's not about the problem. It's about the solution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I didn't intend that. I just had to say, here's what happened. But the last half of the book is, here's what I tried to do to get out of the hole I was in.
Right.
And that's exactly what the grandma book is about, is my healing journey to try to overcome a writer's block that got me to walk away from two books that the publishing industry wanted to publish.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are they still interested in these books to publish?
I self-published the first one.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going to self-publish the next one because the traditional publishing industry, in my opinion, is falling into disarray and they just don't seem to know it yet.
I know. And this way you can get it out faster and people will have access to it quicker and
yeah,
so
exactly.
Forth.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you get a contract with a reputable traditional publisher, you're going to do all your own publicity anyway. And
I know.
I've got a marketing degree and an MBA and tons of experience. I've been doing publicity for an author out in L.A., getting book signings and things like that. I've got so much experience in that arena as well that I just apply it to my book. I'm not just, hey, does somebody want my book? I go out there and let people know about it.
Right
on.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a healing tool. It's not a book. It's a healing tool in some way.
Right. In fact, that's why I envisioned you helping people to unblock everybody has trauma.
Sure.
Everybody has,
sure.
Just by the nature of being alive, we have our own blocks that need to be released. And I think that's what this book is telling me about you.
Sure. Well, and it's funny because, for instance, I know somebody who has a master's degree in English and has not written anything in 20 years because they picked on her in graduate school in English.
Mm.
Because she wasn't
mm-hmm.
writing like the current buzz terms were you were supposed to write.
Right.
And that's what I hear you saying is those traumas can come from anywhere and don't have to be deeply buried in PTSD. So I think we've given me a direction that I didn't quite see before, and I still don't see the hows, but basically what I do is I say, Dear God, show me the way, and then turn it over to what I call the Ways and Means Committee.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
You just say, show me the way. Blind man standing by the side of the road saying, show me the way, and the ways and means for how you can share that gift and those
mm-hmm.
gifts will be revealed to you. Don't worry about
mm-hmm.
it. So you've given
yes,
me
that's
a
beautiful,
gift.
That's a yes, and it's a great prayer, turning it over to the Ways and Means Committee.
let's say it this way. It works a lot better than what I used to do, which was, Dear God, here's what it needs to look like, and here's when it needs to happen.
there's a great deal of letting go. You're letting go, letting God. You're releasing it. You're releasing it.
I'm releasing the outcome. But one of the things I connected with somebody recently who is developing her business plan as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had a business plan for Dan Hayes Creative Person since 1987.
Mm-hmm.
The mission statement of that writer's plan, that business plan, is to steward my God-given talents in a God-centered yet goal-oriented manner.
Beautiful.
And it was like, let's keep it simple. I can hang on to that.
Yeah.
Because I've had my writing gift and my creative gift has been confirmed so dramatically in so many ways that
mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to steward it. That's my job.
Right.
Even if I have to go down into the deep well of digging out grandma's crap.
Whenever we're being stymied with the message that we can't do what it is that we are born to do, that's
sure.
a very sad commentary. And we have to get rid of it.
Have to get that out. It's funny because you get these messages sometimes in really interesting ways. I happened to watch a rerun of the TV show Friday Night Lights
mm-hmm.
about Texas football, and there's this one scene that I'd forgotten about where the coach is saying to this young player who's trying out in college, he said, listen to me. God has put you in this place at this time to do what you do best.
Mm-hmm.
Go all the way.
Go all the way, right on. Hey, that's a good way to end this show. Because we've
there
come
you go.
To the end of this. Go all the way, Dan. That's what you must do. That's what I have to do. And
sure.
we all meet online so we can help each other.
Absolutely.
That's my philosophy. So good luck to you. And when you start publishing your other books, you can come back and we'll talk some more.
Absolutely, Kate. I'd love to.
Great. And I'm going to be playing another little segment of this music for Mother and Child. by Klaus C. Jensen. And another thing, Dan, is Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful year ahead.
You bet.
Full of vast creativity.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Kate. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Dan.